a second run, that feels good to me. Now it takes a second to start recording. Okay. Well, it's Brody and Brianna. The Gruesome Twosome. That's a name that we're trying it out for now. We might stick with it. We might not.
Hey.
Hell yeah. So, I have a little bit of planned, not any talk for specifically for the podcast, but I guess I just have some intentions coming into this, some backup material that we can lean on. Which is just what I've been learning about today, that kind of thing. And then in between, hopefully, ideally my hopes and ambitions for this podcast is that we can bounce between topics and throw in like little anecdotes or, you know.
Like last time?
Yeah, just interesting little departures from like a kind of a structure that hopefully the structured, planned parts will kind of give us a little freedom, you know, feel like we're getting it underway and, you know, ease up the pressure. Last time that we did a podcast, I guess right now, the pregame a little bit, we're talking about doing the podcast. Mm-hmm. That's the first step here. But last podcast, I noticed that we felt a lot of pressure throughout the recording. And like probably like 45 minutes in, it felt like it finally loosened up. And we finally had it going, and then it was just kind of already over.
It was over.
It took that long, you know, for the nervousness to kind of wear off. Maybe we'll get better with it.
Yeah.
With time, or, you know, if I can change my mindset to recognize, like, this shit doesn't fucking matter. But, you know, whatever. We'll get through it this time.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you have any more opening notes before I try to move into the meat and potatoes here?
Well, can we say how our day was real quick?
Oh, how was your day, Brianna? I'm so sorry. I didn't ask you.
My day was good, I guess. I think it was good. Oh, yeah? I went to work. I just got home a little while ago. About to smoke and listen to you. Hopefully I'll have some notes.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've had a pretty good day.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
I've had a pretty good day, too.
Just about to ask that.
Yeah, well, it's... I don't know. I don't like judging the whole day under, like, one single title. Because it feels difficult to me to... Because there were ups and downs, and most things I don't really like to class as being good or bad. They're just kind of, like, interesting or new or...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
I get it.
Yeah, at this fucking point, I mean, you know I don't... It's confusing verbiage to me, but anyways, so I'm in the process of getting a little bit of like overview knowledge, right? I'm going right into it.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a little bit of overview knowledge and an introduction into different like historical movements and periods and, you know, nations and empires, that kind of thing. And a part of my learning process is, you know, watching, reading, listening, consuming information. And then I think it's really important to, after that, try and recall and explain the information. Sort of like Feynman technique is what they might call it sometimes. But anyway, so because I was already planning on doing this with Brianna in the day generally, I'm going to do this now during the podcast. It's kind of two birds, one stone, the situation here. I have some shit that I need to yap about, basically, just for my learning process. And so I'm going to try to do it on the podcast. A couple of disclaimers moving forward, though. I do not know what the fuck I'm talking about. And also, I can't really claim any kind of credit for what I'm saying, right? So I just want to make it clear that I got to test out this information, and I know that some of this is probably going to be wrong, and I probably have like a loose and unclear understanding already just because I'm unfamiliar with the material, right? I'm moving into new territory here with my learning journey here, and I got to test it out. I got to talk like I know some shit that I don't actually know, and I'm going to try to explain it. Right, and typically people explain things because they have a foundation of knowledge and they know what they're talking about. I'm not trying to do that. It might sound like this at times. This happened, I might say, and then this happened. I don't necessarily know, because I've only done a cursory surface level of research.
Yeah.
So, okay. You know, I'm testing it out. And also something else is that, you know, I didn't come to these kinds of conclusions that I'm going to be giving you on my own. I will need to do a lot more research, and I'll also need time after this to think on these kinds of ideas, and, you know, I'll need to hear other people's perspectives, and I'll need to do a lot more cooking on this information and processing it to actually develop my own conclusions or opinions or, you know, anyways, so, whatever, I'm wrong about the shit. I'm going to talk about Roman history, which is pretty well researched. I mean, it's a lot of people know more about it than I do. So it's what I'm going to say is going to the educated person, to the person who's very aware on this topic, is going to be insulting. It's going to be an ignorant, reductive oversimplification.
Maybe not. Maybe they can see that you're wanting to learn it and they're going to feel good about it. Don't go straight into hating.
I'm not saying that they're going to hate it. I don't think that. But what I'm saying is that it's going to, you know, I'm oversimplifying, and I don't have an in-depth understanding. And I'm just saying I know that, and I'm testing it out. I just want to put that disclaimer ahead of time. I'm not the authority on the subject, and I'm not assuming to be. Also, yeah, and of course, I did already say, but, you know, this is not my show. I'm not taking credit for this either. You know, it feels weird because we're putting this into, like, a product in the form of the podcast. I don't want to be putting out a product that is made up of somebody else's materials, because that feels inauthentic and that feels like stealing, maybe. But this is just a conversation that we're recording. So it's just a conversation. Yeah. And I don't want any kind of credit for this. I renounce the credit for this conversation. So hopefully that's an adequate disclaimer. Anyways, so the characterization that I've got from Professor Jang, he talks about the cultural character of the Roman civilization, and how that is more important in analyzing Rome's success in their various conflicts than the kind of literal factors that historians might typically assess whenever they're looking at Roman history. So let me be clear. A lot of the time, whenever people analyze and compare different maybe you could say principalities. I need to look up what principalities means right quick. But whenever you compare different civilizations, because, you know, Rome was a kingdom, and then it was a republic, and then it was an empire. So I'm looking for a term that kind of encapsulates all of that. I is it okay to Google something on the podcast? I'm not sure.
I think it's all right.
Principalities. A territorial or political entity ruled by a prince or a high-ranking spiritual being. So, I don't know. Maybe that's a catch-all term. But anyways, so typically whenever a historian might analyze, you know, who's gonna succeed in a war, or what are benefits and, you know, downsides to, like, a nation, they might analyze things like how technologically advanced is the civilization. Mm-hmm. Right, in the Roman times, let's just say, like, you know, starting at like 750 BCE, around this time, we're talking about, like, who has more advanced weapons, and, you know, who has weapons built out of better material, who has access to armor, that kind of thing. And then historians might analyze and quantify, like, manpower. How many people do they have in mm-hmm. their military?
Yeah.
And they might also analyze wealth or their access to resources, right? How much money do they have? How much food do they have? You know,
what friends do they have with the connections that they need?
That's
Maybe.
That's almost a separate, but I guess.
I feel like that's also, like, with the money.
Sure. It's definitely tied in there. But anyways, what I just meant to look at the dichotomy of what factors play into a nation's ability to succeed in conflict, and I'm trying to differentiate between the literal physical. So a connection is kind of, that's like politics. That's almost not, anyways, what Professor Jang suggests is more important to analyze is the, again, the cultural identity, the character, and the value system of a nation. Mm-hmm. And he says that this is actually much more important in determining who's going to win a war, who's going to succeed, what kind of civilization is going to last over a longer, you know, period of time. And he breaks it down into like three really important factors, especially I think concerning war. But cohesion, which is how, you know, unified the people are in mm-hmm. the nation. And then he also looks at discipline, which is basically how much training the people have undergone, what their actual ability is. And then he looks at devotion, which basically, why do the people want to fight and how much do they really want their success in whatever kind of conflict they're going to have? You yeah. know what I mean? So these factors they're less quantifiable, they're less literal. And I think that definitely makes them more difficult to actually analyze. You know, like, how do you judge the discipline of a nation? Like, in any military force, there's different people, and they have different levels of training, especially right. throughout history, whenever it wasn't such a, like, systematic process. So it's complicated to actually analyze these, and I think that's probably why a lot of historians tend to focus their discussion on the more literal aspects, the numbers that can be a little bit more agreed upon, and we can have a discussion about the material, and we can have, you know, a sense of what's right and what's wrong, you know, whereas these qualitative aspects, like how unified are the people, it's more complicated to discuss. So again, you know, I'm hearing one person's view. At this point, I'm hearing one or only a few people's view yeah. on the subject. So I don't totally... I certainly cannot make a judgment of the devotion of a people based on the small amount of research that I've heard. But anyways. So he analyzes Rome, and he says that Rome is generally a poor nation, especially at the very beginning of its foundation. And it is surrounded basically by these other powers. So it's the generally considered beginning of Rome is around 750 BC. We gotta pause right quick. I gotta go check my water, see if it's boiling. So Rome is basically a city in modern day Italy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Italy is like a peninsula, hopefully that's the proper, it's a peninsula, it's a little piece of land that basically juts into the Mediterranean Sea, and they are basically able to acquire a lot of their wealth, and they build their culture off of their trading, because they live right by the water, so there's constantly ships coming in and out, and, you know, they're able to develop, like, kind of a diverse culture. It's an amalgamation of other cultures that are nearby. Another pressure that's kind of acting. So I guess I'm going to start by describing the kind of pressures, the kind of factors that are at play that are going to come into play later whenever Rome, like, starts expanding. But an important factor is that there are nearby, I want to say, like, entities, I guess maybe it's just the easiest way, because I don't know necessarily are these kingdoms, are these, I think a lot of these places are kingdoms, but there are the Carthaginians. Mm-hmm. It is another civilization. I don't know if it's right to call them an empire, but the Carthaginians are basically, they're a Phoenician culture, okay. which means that they're like African. Mm-hmm. And they are extremely wealthy in comparison to Rome. Okay. And they are expanding their territory around this time at the formation of Rome. And they have a very different culture because they are they're wealthy in comparison. And the people that lead the Carthaginian society are basically, they're primarily motivated by profit and what's good for them, what's generally considered good, the morality, the cultural identity is more focused on trade and, making money, right? As opposed to, you know, they did have like religion and they did have like ritual sacrifice. That's something that history has kept, that's knowledge that's been kept on the Carthaginians. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, the history isn't perfectly exactly clear because eventually Carthage is completely dominated by Rome and Rome destroys their history and basically wipes them out. So what is remembered and, you know, what kind of knowledge is kept on Carthage is at least in some ways influenced by the political propaganda that Rome wants to, you know, because obviously Rome ended up destroying them. And of course they're going to be like, well, those guys were, they were bad. They did a lot of human sacrifice. But Carthage was a growing power in the region. And one of the most important, like, events basically was there was a, general, there was a military leader from Carthage that saw Rome as being expansionist. So over time, Rome is kind of gaining momentum and they're building up a military, and this is how Professor Jang describes it. I'm not 100%. I'm not saying I know this. Anyways, Rome develops a really strong culture, almost like the cult of Rome. They have people that are very, very dedicated to Roman culture and the glory of Rome, and this kind of another page of notes I'm not finding. This gives them a unique advantage in the battles that they're going to eventually come into, because people really, even whenever Rome is facing a more technologically advanced power, they are very dedicated and devoted to the glory of Rome and to dying for Rome. And so there are going to be situations whenever Carthage begins to try and overpower Rome, mm-hmm. that there are going to be situations, and particularly the Battle of Cannae, where Rome is completely overwhelmed, they're completely destroyed, and they suffer immense losses, but they continue the fight.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm missing a sheet of my notes. I don't remember exactly where I was.
Well, you found the page.
Uh-huh. Do you remember? So the Carthaginians are the dominant force. Okay, they, at this time, Rome might have a slightly more sophisticated navy, but I'm pretty sure they don't have a navy, actually, now that I say that. I think that they're mostly a land power, but anyways, Hannibal Barcus is a really skilled leader from Carthage, and he sees Rome as an expanding power, and he basically suggests that we need to stop Rome, right? If we don't go and fuck them up, they're going to eventually become such a powerful enemy that they're going to be able to overwhelm us. And so he goes, I'm trying to like draw a map here in the air, but he, coming from Carthage, which is like in the most northern parts of Africa, right? Mm-hmm. So that's on the southern side of the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah, it's still low.
He goes through Spain.
So he goes up.
He goes up, but this is up, and this is up north diagonal. And to the west.
Yeah.
This is north and to the west of Italy. Okay. He goes up through Spain, and then he comes through the Alps, which is a mountain range. Mm-hmm. that it, during the winter time, you really, it is unknown to cross it.
Right. It's that he almost does. Unbearable.
Well, he suffers a lot of loss of his troops, but along the way, he's like replenishing his troops because there's many other enemies in the city-states nearby Rome. Some of the other city-states are like the Etruscans are basically the leader in this area, and they're amongst the Petrusians, or I'm sorry, amongst the Etruscans and, you know, other local powers, Hannibal is able to, like, rally up enough people that are willing to fight against Rome. And maybe, you know, the wealth of Carthage is behind him, and maybe that also allows him to develop more troops. I'm not 100% sure, but... So he starts, you know, once he makes it through the Alps, it's pretty clear that he now is, like, contesting Rome. Mm-hmm. They weren't going to do shit, you know, even if they knew about him coming close. They weren't going to do anything until they now know that he's here and he has a vast army.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they go out and they actually confront him at the Battle of Cannae.
Mm. And Cannae is where?
I don't know. Northern Italy, right around south of the Alps.
Okay.
In that kind of region. I'm not sure. Anyways. Most of the maps that I was looking at were period, like, sensitive. They were of that time. So I'm not sure exactly where it is now. But anyways, knowing that Hannibal knows that the Romans have superior military power. The Romans have gathered an army force of about, like, 80,000, which is pretty significant. Their plan... Because of their culture and because of their mindset going into this, is they're just going to throw numbers at him. Okay. The Romans are very devoted, so they're willing to die for their cause pretty easily. And so they march up to meet Hannibal, and Hannibal, knowing that they have superior numbers, basically decides to fight them at a choke point. Are you familiar with this?
No.
A choke point is just a tight, enclosed area where by forcing like somebody to go through a choke point, you reduce the advantage that they have in their numbers because only so many can come through at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in a like open battle on the open field, the side that has more troops could spread out wider. So that way everyone can see you, and if they were archers, then they could shoot at you, or mm-hmm. they could charge from such a wide, they could use their numbers.
Yeah.
But if you force them through a choke point, you only have to fight a couple at a time. Like, yeah. They have to come at, like, if they're, you know, in row, they're in smaller rows, they have to come one at a time. And, you know, the Romans at this point, I guess, they're very confident. So they don't mind pushing up through this choke point. Additionally, he also has the high ground.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, in any kind of battle, in any kind of engagement, definitely this is a huge advantage. It's always a huge advantage.
Yeah.
You know, like for visibility, and, you know, you just have the momentum on your side, and, you know, of gravity. And anyways, something that Hannibal does is he weakens his center forces, the forces that are in the middle, and he has them stand in almost like a concave formation. This is how Professor Jang said it. I looked it up some, and some of the drawings that I saw didn't represent it this way, so maybe I'll have to look more into it. But they're set up in a concave formation, and of course there's not very many troops in the middle, right? We have more rows out to the side, and these troops are all like they're mixed and matched. Some of them are Africans, some of them are Gauls, which is another people from around that area. Okay, they're they're varied, and they're not in like a known formation to the Romans. So the Romans are like, oh shit, these guys really don't know what they're doing. So we're just going to push right up through them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're going to fucking destroy them. As they get engaged with the main central troops, they start breaking through the Carthaginian line. And those middle troops start to like back up, basically taking it from a concave formation to a convex formation.
Mm-hmm.
which, you know, that's like, now their troops are encircling, the Carthaginians are encircling the Romans. At the same time, the cavalry, the guys on the horses that are out on the flanks, out on the sides, mm-hmm. they've pushed up, and the Carthaginian cavalry is superior to the Roman cavalry. So they're just beating the hell out of the Roman horses, mm-hmm. and those horsemen have to end up retreating. And so the Carthaginian cavalry can now close in behind. Mm. So basically, the Carthaginian force has completely surrounded the Romans at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And they inflict heavy losses. Somewhere of around like 70,000 men die in this battle. 70,000 Romans. They just get completely destroyed. It is an uncontested win. It is just, it's a very big deal. It's a very big victory. And, you know, this kind of, this should really shake Rome to their core. Like, that they lost so many troops and that they were just so thoroughly and handily destroyed. And you know, Hannibal, of course, believes this. And so Hannibal starts, like, wanting to have peace talks at this point. He's like, listen, you know, you guys are getting fucking destroyed, but we can come to some kind of resolution. And, you know, you would think that the Romans would be kind of like, their spirit would be broken. This should, like, shake their morale. But Professor Jang argues that this actually doesn't, and they don't enter into peace talks, even mm-hmm. though they lose, like, they lose about 20% of their adult male population.
Dang. From the battle?
I'm not sure if that's from this battle alone or from, like,
from, like, a few of them.
Around this time, yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But there's a point, at least, where they've lost about 20% of their adult men, which he compares to, like, in World War I, Germany lost only about 10% before they started, like, entering into peace talks.
Mm.
And, you know, so 20%, it's a very significant number. But he argues that this, you know, and a large percentage also of the Roman Senate, which is a, you know, just a part of their gubernatorial system, there's a lot of open spaces now. And he argues that because the Romans are so dedicated and because they really value bringing glory to Rome and rising through the ranks in the Roman government, that this isn't really that bad for them. They don't really mind. Like, maybe I shouldn't say they don't mind, but this is not enough to make them not want to fight. Because, you know, people want to be going up through the ranks, and, yeah. you know, they want to... Giving up Rome would be, like, terrible. You know, because he basically... After he mentions this, he goes into, now, the Roman character. He digs a little bit more deep into, you know, their value system. And he defines, like, their main driving values, and he kind of describes them in comparison to the Carthaginians and also to the Greeks, which is a nearby power at this time, right? Greece is very close to Rome.
Yeah.
But Rome will eventually overtake Greece, but at this point, you know, they're very distinct peoples. And anyways, basically, he describes the people of Rome to be, you know, they believe that serving their country is, like, a really important duty, and, you know, surrendering is almost like sacrilegious. It's very, very bad, and this is part of the reason why I'm actually about to go. But this is part of the reason why they're able to achieve so much success in the region. I'm gonna go ahead and. Yep. So some of the important sources that he references in order to describe why Romans are so dedicated and how deep that belief goes is, firstly, the origin of Rome, how it was founded, and then also the story of Lucius Brutus. And there's a couple of other characters, but basically the story of the foundation of Rome, in over simple terms, they do these, like, really atrocious things. Romulus and Remus are, there's a story of two brothers that get into these different wars with people, and basically they commit a ton of rape, and they in order to bring peace with the people that they've attacked and raped, they accept, they give them citizenship status of Rome. Okay, that's one of the, like, founding myths of Rome, that establishes their collective cultural identity. And, you know, I'm not getting the details right, obviously, but it kind of establishes that violence is an important part of their culture and that it's accepted in the name of Roman glory. And, you know, also they, another important part of why Rome is able to succeed over these nearby city-states is that citizenship is very easy to gain, right? They have a lot of different peoples gain citizenship. There's a lot of immigration into Rome, and that allows them to build their forces up over time. You know, these other city-states nearby, like Greek city-states, for example, they're very proud, and they're kind of exclusive. Like, you can't really become a citizen of Sparta. You have to have been born there, really. It's not, being Spartan is important to their pride, and you don't get to just become that. Whereas Rome, you can become a citizen. The other factor, maybe I wasn't clear on this. The Roman mythology, okay, the stories that they tell and their history, they're not really distinguished. Their history is myth. And it's almost like there is a religion to their society that is, like, deeply connected to their power structure, right? In America at this point, we have this kind of idea of, like, separation of church and state.
Well, not so much anymore.
Well, sure, obviously the lines get crossed, but they're separate entities. They're in this age of the Roman society, as far as I can tell, limited research, but it's serving in their, like, government is very closely related to godliness. And, at the beginning, right, it's a Roman kingdom. So the king holds a lot of these titles. But the story of Lucius Brutus, which is partially mythology, partially history, right? Maybe Lucius Brutus really existed, but the story that I'm about to tell you is likely exaggerated in some way.
Right.
But basically,
this is centuries, correct? Centuries and centuries and centuries ago.
Well, at this point, this is the story of Lucius Brutus is around 509 BCE.
So
that would be about 3,000 years ago. Or I'm sorry, that would be about 2,500 years ago.
So that's still a lot of centuries ago?
Yes.
Okay.
25.
Nice.
Anyways, so he at the time, Rome has a king called Tarquinius Superbus.
Okay.
Which basically translates to Tarquin the Arrogant. Okay, because he's not very liked by history. He's remembered as being basically an asshole. But Tarquinius, he is off doing something. He's outside of the kingdom. And Licinius Brutus he's like high-ranking official. I don't remember what exactly his title is. But his sister-in-law it's like his friend's sister, I don't remember exactly, she's raped by one of the princes of the king.
Okay. Of that king, of the one that he...
Yes,
okay.
the one that's ruling, but not here. And she comes to Lucius Brutus and her husband, and she tells them... Her name was, I think, Luceria? Lucretia? Something like that. She comes to them and she tells them, you have to avenge me. You have to do something about this guy. Uh-huh. He's like a known rapist. He rapes all the time.
Okay, Jesus.
And so she has them promise that they'll avenge her, and they're like, yeah, okay, we'll avenge you in the morning, okay? We'll do that tomorrow. And she doesn't totally believe them, so she kills herself. So that way, they will be honor-bound to go and to fuck this king up and kill him, or this prince.
Dang.
So they do, and in the process, basically, Lucius Brutus... I guess maybe because they realize that there's no going back to the king at this point, he locks up the gates.
Okay.
And locking the king out now, they begin to break down the king's power structure. And they form into place the Republic of Rome.
Okay.
And so basically, before this time, the king had absolute power over military decisions, over judicial decisions. Mm-hmm. He's basically, you know, the king judge. Also, legislative roles, like making laws.
Yeah.
And he's also the highest level of the religious happenings. And also, you know, the administrative, the what public services are done, jeez, making roads, whatever. He does all of this. And whenever the Republic is put in place, uh-huh, these are all broken down into individual institutions.
Okay.
Basically, like, they become more meritocratic as well, because a lot of these positions you are elected into.
Meritocratic? Election?
Well, meritocracy is the idea that basically if you're good at something, you will be promoted and you will develop a rank based on your skill. And so now that these things, I don't know if they're necessarily considered to be democratic. I don't know if every one of these positions is like fairly voted in or whatever. But the point is that before it was nobility that's running everything, and now it's, I think it is still nobility, but whatever. It's split up. The tasks are split up.
Yeah.
Anyways. So Tarsinius, this king that has been outcast, right? He decides he's going to go to one of these, like, nearby city-states that maybe where he was from before or something. He goes and he tries to rally up troops. And he ends up, like, persuading another king to bring his armies to help him retake Rome.
Okay.
So they show up and they're planning on retaking Rome, and they're across the Tiber River, which is a river that, like, Rome is basically, like, right on. Anyways. They're out here, they're camping, and they're having, like, this massive feast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the Romans decide that they need to assassinate the king. That would be the best way to break apart these forces and break their will to fight. And so, a character named Gaius Mucius Quartus, just Mucius, we could call him, decides that he's going to be the one who goes over there and assassinates the king.
Okay.
Whenever he shows up, it's actually payday. So the soldiers are getting paid, and there's two people up on this podium that are dressed very fancy, and he can't tell which one is the king and which one is the king's scribe. So he basically is like, I don't know what to do. He just is like, it's 50-50, fuck it, I'm just going to kill one of them. So he kills one of them, and it turns out it was the wrong guy.
Well, yeah, of course.
So he gets arrested.
Yeah.
And the king starts up this, like, huge fire, and he tells Mucius, I'm going to burn you in this fucking fire unless you tell me, you know, where are the other spies.
Who sent you?
Well, I don't think he's curious about that, but just where are the other spies? And Mucius says something to the effect, I read a longer quote whenever I looked into it, but Mucius says something to the effect of, like, well, there's 300 of us spies. I was the first of 300 young men to volunteer to kill you. We want you dead. We're going to kill you no matter what. And, you know, me dying isn't going to change that. And he's like, just to show you, like, what the value of our body is in comparison to the value of our goals. I'm gonna stick my hand in this fire. So he sticks his hand in the fire, mm-hmm, and he burns and he doesn't react. He just sticks his hand in the fire to, like, show the king, like, I don't give a fuck about burning. I have a goal. I have a mission. I'm devoted.
Yeah.
Now, is this true or is this not true?
Yeah, I don't know.
It doesn't really matter. because this is the myth that Romans are familiar with, and they retell this story, and they love this story, and it fills them with pride about being a Roman, and it instills this, like, idea of self-sacrifice for the great, for the glory of Rome. And the, so the, what happens in the story, the king says, all right, well, I can see that you're just, you're so super dedicated, I might as well just fucking go home. Like, I don't, I'm not even gonna fight you. So I'm just gonna give up and go home. And, you know, the, these Romans, they're crazy. So he leaves. And so Rome is allowed to continue its democracy. Another part of the Lucius Brutus story is that he, at some point, there are plots to reinstate the king and to bring back the king's authority into Rome. And Lucius Brutus, two of his sons are indicted. They are...
What does that mean?
They're captured and they're charged with the crime of conspiring, like, against the government, basically. They were intending to reinstate the king. And Lucius Brutus, who is... I believe he's, like, one of the chief council members. The consul. I'm not sure if those are meant to be pronounced differently, if one of them's just the Latin version of the same word, but he's... The consul is, like, the highest level, basically. I believe it's basically the highest level of the, like, military... They oversee the military and they make all those decisions, but I think they're even higher, like... They're also over the Senate, right? Which the Senate makes the legislative decisions. I don't know. The Pontifex Maximus is the title that's given to the person who is, like, the religious... The highest priest. I think... I could be wrong. I'm not sure. I think that the consul is even over them. It's one or the other. Whatever. They're both high up there. My point is Lucius Brutus holds a really important title. And he is, like, charged with now... He overseeing the death of both of his sons. Because the punishment's death for them trying to go against... Bring the king back. And Lucius Brutus, as the story goes, he... You know, he chooses to just watch his sons be killed. And he cries, and, you know, it was a public event, so all of the people of Rome, they see They see him cry, but they see him go through with killing his own sons. Because that, again, the important themes of these Roman myths is that that is the sacrifice that people of Rome are willing to... They're willing to sacrifice anything for Rome. And for the, you know... The development and the progress and the greatness of Rome. And, you know, these stories are circulated and they're repeated and, you know, it's really powerful propaganda. You know, Lucius Brutus is like a great figure. And eventually, you know, whenever... So Rome is going to exist basically as a republic for like 500 years before it becomes an empire. I believe that's under Caesar. And eventually Caesar is going to be killed. And whenever Caesar is killed, he is killed like people are remembering the greatness of Lucius Brutus. He's killed in some ways by the sentiments that have are inspired and remembered in these stories of the foundation of Rome and of Lucius Brutus. Because, you know, it's just so, it's so great. The myth is so important. You know, what it represents and the values that it instills in the people. So I guess I'm kind of pausing a little bit right now. I'm reorganizing my thoughts a little bit. Like I'm it's too much dead air.
It's okay.
I'm running out of steam a little bit.
Hi. I feel like I haven't talked much. Yeah. It's all right. What else do you need to say about?
I did also continue to do a little bit of thinking about the Greek civilization, which he taught first, even though they're kind of happening at the same time. I guess I guess he talked about Greek civilization first because he wanted to establish Greek culture, and then eventually talk about whenever Rome takes over, their mixing of cultures.
Uh-huh.
He compared, like I said, whenever he talked about the values of Rome, he compared the Greek values again, and the Greek have these values that basically cause them to be very creative, but also to be more individualistic and less unified than the Roman people. Mm-hmm. In other words, Greeks, they create all of this really great art. They do this fantastic writing and their plays. They create a beautiful and diverse culture, but they don't have the same... They're not willing to throw themselves to the machine the way that Romans are. You know, they don't have that kind of sense of glory through self-sacrifice. You know, there are these Greek values like arete and eudaimonia. In eudaimonia, arete is basically like you have a purpose in your life, and you the best thing for you to do is to fulfill that purpose, is to play your role and develop your skill and ability. Basically, like your arete, if you're a member of a military force, is to be as good of a soldier as you can be. Your arete, if you're a craftsman, is to just do your craft as good as you possibly can be. And it basically, it's like excellence.
Uh-huh.
And also another Greek value is their, they really value their freedom, and particularly their freedom to speak their minds, right? Whenever the Greeks were developing their polises, which again is kind of like a governmental structure, they were speaking their minds and having political discussions, and that was a big part of what makes you Greek, and that's a big part of what is important about being Greek, is being able to speak your mind. And, you know, as Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, as their ideas begin to spread and philosophy begins to, you know, become like a recognized concept, this is going to be, you know, compounded. They're really going to value basically talking their shit, you know, having their worldview. And anyways, the other concept was eudaimonia. And eudaimonia is a complicated idea. The most common translation is flourishing.
Okay.
Eudaimonia is about developing yourself, and it's about leading a fulfilling life more than it is about achieving pleasure. Have you ever heard of hedonism?
Mm-mm.
Well, hedonism is this, you could call it like a philosophical standpoint. It's almost just like a state. Basically, hedonism is the idea that the proper way to be happy in this life is just to feel good, right? Okay. That's what happiness is about, and we should pursue pleasures, and we should pursue feeling good as often as we can. Trying to be generous with it, you know, like, it's the idea that, you know, we should avoid pain, and we should just try to feel good, right? Life is ultimately about feeling pleasure and enjoying, and that's the proper way to live life. Eudaimonia can be contrasted with that, because eudaimonia is really about like serving a larger purpose, and you can be achieving eudaimonia, you can be in the process of achieving eudaimonia while going through a type of a struggle or a pain,
mm-hmm.
as long as you're doing it for the right reasons and as long as you're pursuing a goal. Okay, so a big part of achieving eudaimonia, or, you know, living life correctly, flourishing as a human being, is about having values, okay, like a belief in what's right and what's wrong, and conducting yourself in line with those values, being a virtuous person, okay, trying to do the right thing, and, you know, not just doing anything that feels good to you, but doing what is right. Another aspect of eudaimonia is, you know, your personal growth, developing your skills, right? Developing your ability, right? I'm kind of interpreting this. I'm not exactly sure. You know, I could read more and find that I'm kind of misrepresenting this based on my modern understanding of, like, fulfillment. But basically, I as I understand, there's another aspect of this. It's basically like recognizing your part and playing your part really good. It's kind of similar to Arete, I guess. You have things, basically, that you are the best at doing and that other people can't do as good as you. And so you have kind of like an obligation to do these things, right? If you're a really good speaker, then I think you being in line with eudaimonia, you should speak the right things, you should develop your ability to speak, and you should use this to contribute to your society. Because so that's another important aspect, is giving meaningful contributions to your community, right? Basically, if you are a virtuous person and you practice philosophy and you learn how to reason out what's right and what's wrong, and you develop like moral convictions, this is going to be good for you, but it's also going to be good for the people around you, because you will be able to, you know, instruct them, advise them, share your best self with them, and this is what's good, not just for the individual, but for your whole community. And anyways, basically, I don't find it like completely dissimilar to, you know, other ideas of like living a fulfilling life. And, you know, I think that there's even like a lot of Christian sentiments that follow this kind of line of thought, like, you know, basically that pleasure isn't the path to living the good life, but that, you know, we need to basically be able to put off our pleasure in order to do things that are good for us, you know. I would maybe even compare it kind of like, we shouldn't just eat unhealthy food because it tastes good, but we should eat healthy food, which might not taste as good, but is ultimately, oh, I apologize, hopefully that's not extremely loud to the podcast, but basically we should do what is good for us in the long run, you know, and forego a little bit of the short-term pleasure for long-term fulfillment. And I don't know, I did a little bit of thinking about the eudaimonia today, and, you know, I was kind of wondering, does this seem like a convincing idea to me? Is this a good idea of what I want to achieve in my life? And then also, you know, maybe what are the biases in this perspective? Because I think that, generally speaking, like being skeptical of this idea, generally speaking, people's philosophical justifications, their beliefs, are kind of based around their lifestyle, right? People don't really, and this isn't my idea, I don't remember where this comes from anyways, but people don't really do things because they have reasoned them out and decide that, okay, this isn't in line with my values, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. Because people don't, in their lifetime, they don't develop the ability to think philosophically and question their morals and values before they just are already living life. Like, you pick up and you do things, and then you learn about them as you're doing them, right? Like, throughout your life, you are probably going to live and operate and make decisions based on the example that people around you have given you, your parents, your community, your school, in our case, in our society, and, you know, you're going to already be doing these things whenever you start to become exposed to other people's philosophical ideas, right? Your parents give you basically a framework of what's right and what's wrong through their words or through their actions, and then later in life you start to be exposed to other people's ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, even at the earliest stages of you being exposed to others' ideas, I don't think that skepticism is natural. You're not naturally going to be questioning your way whenever you see other people's way. You're going to be
questioning theirs.
Yeah, you're going to more easily dismiss the things that you're not doing in favor of what you are doing. You know, and I think that this is just, it's almost human instinct to possess conservative worldview. In other words, to want to maintain things the way that they were.
Mm-hmm.
And because it already worked, it already worked. If it worked for your parents and they lived long enough to reproduce and now you're here, well, then their worldview, it works. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think that that's like the standard model of looking at things. Anyways, so when analyzing now Eudaimonia, I think that to some degree it is has to be shaped by the lifestyles that the people there were already living. I'm not sure if that would have picked up. It wasn't that loud, did it?
That you see that? Spiked more than the other.
Oh.
Anyways. I apologize.
Anyways, though, so I don't know. Maybe like they do talk about, for example, like developing a skill. That's a part of Eudaimonia, and maybe you could say that that's like it could be influenced. Let me say this: Aristotle, who is I don't know if he was I definitely don't think he was the first one to mention Eudaimonia, but it's a point that in his writings is heavily discussed. Aristotle was an aristocrat in his society. He was wealthy. He comes from his father was like the I'm not sure what the term was. He was a doctor for the king, basically.
Dang.
So Aristotle is a rich kid. Okay? And you know, there's probably like that's an undercurrent. That's an influence. That's a shaping factor that forms his worldview.
Yeah.
And you know, he could value developing skill, maybe because it separates him from the poorer people who, you know, maybe don't do so much developing other skill because they don't have so much time because they have to spend more of their time surviving, right? So maybe, I'm just saying, like, because there was, like, a strict class system in Greece, in Athens at that time, maybe he was kind of, like, exclusionary. He wants to be part of an elite club, and whenever he is going to describe what is the perfect way to live life, he's probably going to want it to conform to this air of importance. He wants to feel that he is an important person. You know, and people obviously, you know, they want to develop, they want a worldview that justifies what they're already doing. I don't know. Maybe in my view of what the properly lived life, maybe it doesn't need to be so centralized around developing a skill. Because something that I feel, now I'm going off the script here. Is this fine?
Yeah.
Something that I feel is that ambition, especially like to its extreme, is harming our world today, our sense of happiness today, and our sense of direction, what we believe is a life well lived, is heavily predicated. It's built on this idea of ambition. That's a cornerstone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people are seeking self-excellence and self-development in this just being good at something or getting better at something or producing more, becoming more productive, becoming more efficient, becoming optimized. And I don't know, maybe what it comes down to is that this can be balanced and we can moderate this with other sources of happiness or other pursuits. You know, because maybe it shouldn't be all or nothing. In my mind, I'm wondering if this has a place in the well-lived life. Because certainly, let me say this. I want to use an example, a reducto ad absurdum. I want to go to, if you're pure ambition, you will sacrifice everything else in your life in order to achieve this ambition. There's this movie that's very popular called Whiplash. And it's about a guy basically that wants to be the best drummer. He wants to, I guess, maybe I shouldn't say wants to be the best. He wants to be the best drummer that he can be. That's an ambition that he has. It's a goal. And he's doggedly obsessed and committed. And, you know, maybe he's devoted to this task. And throughout the process of the movie, I've never seen it. This is my understanding. Throughout the process of the movie, though, he's basically, I just know from the trailer and people's discussion on it, he's basically sacrificing everything at the altar of ambition, mm-hmm. at the altar of self-excellence and development and becoming the best. Like, there's this scene, I only know from the trailer, where he is breaking up with his girlfriend. He's giving up love, basically, is how mm-hmm. I interpreted it. Because he's like, listen, I'm never going to stop thinking about drumming. It's going to ruin our relationship. Because all I really care about is getting better at this thing. This is my passion. And this is my true goal. This is my true intention. And whenever it comes down to, you know, you or this thing, I have my ambition. I'm going to always regret if I give up my ambition. Right? Yeah. This is kind of a common theme in a lot of movies and stories and I don't know. So I just mentioned this to say, basically, pure ambition and pure devotion to a passion, while it might have beautiful aspects like that you could become the best or that you could develop the most understanding, and certainly like many historical figures, celebrities, even, you know, in recent modern history, you know, people are worshipped. They achieve greatness and glory and fame through extreme devotion. But I think that it causes a person to kind of, they live a life that's not well-rounded as a result. Are we at an hour?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. So anyways, in my understanding of what is the most fulfilling way to live life, I think that ambition, it's at least, let me say this, something I know, is overweighed. It's recognized as being overly important right now in our society. And, you know, I don't know if it has no place. I don't think that we should maybe we shouldn't throw it completely out, because some people, like on the other end of the belief spectrum, might say that doing anything and chasing anything is just completely pointless. Like, you're always going to want more. It's a human nature to always want more. So just try and let that go. That might be another type of philosophical perspective. And I'm not sure if I really want that. At this point, I mean, maybe I haven't understood that. Maybe I haven't done enough reading in that direction. But I don't know. I do enjoy progressing myself, at least to some degree.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess I'll need to do more research into the philosophy, and I'll need to do more thinking on my own to figure out what exactly I want. This doesn't feel like a good ending point, but we are at an hour, and I want to be talking about this and not feel the pressure of recording the podcast. Hopefully that's a good podcast. It was very one note, kind of. I mean, maybe it was historical, so it's probably boring to people that are...
Yeah, well, maybe some people might want to know about this.
If you wanted to know about this, you'd just pull up a Wikipedia article.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Thank you for listening if you did. Have a good day.
Hell yeah.
Thank you.